Hi everyone, hope you had an amazing week. Right, today's episode is a big one. I got to go deep with Tom Sachs on some really interesting topics, from sympathetic magic to the perfect gaffer's tape. If you don't know, Tom Sachs is arguably one of the most inspiring artists working today. Born and bred in New York, of course, I think it's fair to say he's one of contemporary art's seriously heavy hitters, having exhibited all over the world in some of the most prestigious galleries and museums. His unique and experimental approach to making work has made a huge impact on me personally. And of course, he works across film, sculpture, painting, installations. He's even developed his own full-on space programs. It turned out to be a really empowering episode that left me feeling that I could make or do anything. So I hope that has the same impact on you too. Right, on with the episode. It's lovely to spend some time with you. I've been looking forward to this for ages. I'm so glad that you can join us. I know the listeners are going to really appreciate sort of hearing from you. So, you know, one of the things I mentioned to you before is that when I was a kid, I dreamt of having a Commodore Amiga computer. And, you know, like for my parents, they were pretty low income, you know, we didn't have much money. So my only hope of owning a Commodore Amiga was to make this thing out of cardboard, out of cereal boxes. So I created this Commodore Amiga, and I believed that if I prayed to this thing hard enough, it might actually come true. And lo and behold, like at Christmas, a Commodore Amiga 500 actually arrived in my life. So I was convinced that like making these sort of maquettes of things might actually cause things to happen. And I know you've had similar experiences. So I thought maybe we could sort of start there.
I love that, Stuart. I mean, that's an anthropological phenomenon called sympathetic magic. And it is really, it's one of the four pillars of the studio. Is sympathetic magic. I, as a kid, made a Nikon FM2 camera for my father, who wanted one but couldn't afford it. And he wound up getting an Olympus OM2, which was like a little bit less expensive, probably just as good, but maybe not as prestigious as instead. And I remember it kind of stopped there. But later in life, that Olympus OM2 became my camera. He eventually gave it to me when I was old enough. And still to this day, if I were to shoot 35 millimeter film, although I have owned the FM2, I would, if it really mattered, I'd probably go back to the Olympus, because it's like my dying breath camera. Like, I know it more intuitively. I'm not saying I'm good at it. And as much as I still desire the Nikon, that Olympus is more part of my muscle memory.
So how do you think the sympathetic magic works, like at a metaphysical level? Like, what's actually going on? Because I also made a scale model of Disneyland Paris, Tom, in the hope that I'd get to go there. And it took about 35 years to arrive. So I might be getting it a bit wrong.
Well, the thing about sympathetic magic is that you know, all we can ever control is our state of mind. You know, we can't always control the circumstances around us that affect us physically, but we can control to a large degree, even under extreme circumstances, our perspective. And you can see all kinds of people writing about this, especially there's a great tradition of writing of the incarcerated, where we talk about, you know, some people who are physically incarcerated have more freedom than those who are free because of their outlook on life. This is one of the things that you'll read as you study that sort of genre. But the thing about sympathetic magic, and part of the reason I think that we use the word magic, is that it's mystical. And without trying to define that, I would leave it at that we don't fully understand it.
Okay.
Like, you didn't fully understand when or if you would ever get that camera, or when and if you would ever get to Disneyland Paris. And one happened kind of much sooner than the other. Right? It took 35 years to get to Disneyland Paris, but they're all part of your faith. And that's probably the main word, is that you believed and that you have, like, I still haven't been to Disneyland Paris, nor did I ever really want a Commodore. I had other computer desires.
Okay.
That one is yours. And I think that's important that it's yours. My computer desires were, I think I bought every computer that I wanted. I don't think I didn't, but it was later, you know, it was like during Apple or something. But certainly with cameras I had and other things in my life, I had that mm-hmm. desire.
But a Mondrian hasn't arrived yet.
For me.
For you.
Well, so maybe this is worth me telling the story. So I love Piet Mondrian and Dutch de Stijl painter. And when I first moved to my studio in New York 30 something years ago, there was a show at the Museum of Modern Art of his paintings, and I really wanted one. Mm. And I love them so much. And I thought I had to, if I really wanted one, I was going to have to go down to Wall Street and get a job in money organization so that I could organize enough money to buy one, because there are many millions of dollars. Even then, there were the good ones were. And now they're so rare that they don't even come up at auction. I don't even know what one a good one would be. They're all in museums. Mm. Because there are only something like 25 or 30 really great ones, and they're all kind of accounted for. So I didn't think that Wall Street was an authentic use of my time. Because I couldn't believe in it. So I also, at the same time, my studio is still near Canal Street, where there are lots of fakes, like fake Gucci handbags or whatever. And I had an epiphany, and that was I had a pair of Gucci sunglasses that were like $5, and I left them behind at a restaurant. And I was like, oh shit, I left my sunglasses behind. And then I thought, oh, fuck it, just move on with my day and buy another pair later on. But I was thinking, if I had a pair of $300 Gucci sunglasses, which are probably now $700, mm-hmm. those sunglasses would own my ass. And I would certainly go back for those, because that would be irresponsible. And so it occurred to me that there was value, that there were some qualities of the $5 glasses that the $500 ones didn't have. Mm-hmm. They're both sunglasses. They're both Gucci sunglasses. One's authorized by Gucci SPA and the other one isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, one's made in Italy, one's made in China, different qualities. But the idea of not being owned by a possession was a huge plus with those. And so I went to the Museum of Modern Art and I studied those Mondrians, and I got really obsessed. I even got permission to get one off the wall and look at the back. And that, not at MoMA, but at the Wadsworth Athenaeum, where there was a great one, and mm-hmm. really geeked out and studied those Mondrians. And I think I probably spent more time with Victory Boogie Woogie than Cy Newhouse, who owned it and gave it to the museum, did, because he was spending all of his time organizing money to get together to buy the piece and then give it to the museum. Whereas I was spending all my time obsessing about Mondrian. Hmm. And through all that, I spent a lot of time learning about the intricacies of that work of art. And that was the joy. That was the greatest pleasure, and continues to be the best part of my life and my job as an artist, is that I get to spend my time educating and entertaining myself.
Awesome. Yeah. And it is a great painting. I think it's fascinating. I remember going to Amsterdam as a kid with the art college. I mean, what sort of art college takes a bunch of 17-year-olds to Amsterdam for the weekend? I mean, you know, most people didn't make it to the museum, right? But I did. And I spent a long time with those Mondrians as well. And they're phenomenal. I think, is Victory Boogie Woogie unfinished? Is that the last one? Did it end there?
I think so. That's a lozenge or the diamond-shaped one. And I think that's the unfinished one. And to me, that unfinishedness is so beautiful, because you see tape that was used to reference where he might be putting color, and it's just got a good flow. And the shittiness, like his, you know, he was technically such an inept painter, like the they're all really cracked and terrible. And and when I was making my version, I wound up representing those cracks. So I probably left this detail out. I didn't make forgeries of these. I made models of them. So they were made out of gaffer's tape, which is a material that's very authentic to me. I'm not really that good at paint, although I've gotten much better in the past 30 years. Certainly when I made these, duct tape was a material that I had already at a pretty young age a lot of mastery over, because I had made things out of duct tape as a kid, even before I knew that they were called sculptures. I was always making stuff, and duct tape was, and still is, I think, a great material for children because you can't really hurt yourself with it. Mm-hmm. And you can attach anything if you have enough of it.
Do you know what frustrates me about duct tape, though? It's people who mess about cutting it with scissors because it rips perfectly fine. Like, it really annoys me. I'm like, you can just tear it.
Well, they want that clean edge. And I think it's kind of, you can get a perfectly clean edge with scissors or a knife. But the thing about duct tape is it's, you know, there are a bunch of different kinds of duct tape. So I think that, you know, the polyester threads in between that you tear, like there's, I like cheap duct tape because I think it tears better than expensive duct tape.
Okay, fair enough.
And in all fairness, we use gaffer's tape, mm-hmm. not duct tape, which is, it's like, it's polyester backed instead of vinyl backed, and it's matte instead of glossy.
It's just better quality. It's just, it's more of a quality to it.
I think so. It's got more threads per, it's got a higher thread count. It's like fancy sheets.
But it's this sort of like, should you want to talk a bit about like, maybe that handmade nature? I mean, that's one of the things I really love about your work. You know, the fact that your hand is so present in the work, you know, in the process. Like it's got that tactility about it that transcends like being a reproduction or a model of something. It starts to become something else, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, to stick with the Mondrian example for a second, I think physically making the stuff was such a pleasure. I mean, I think I made like 25. I think I made all the Mondrians that I loved. I didn't make any of the ones that I liked. And, you know, spending the time tearing all those bits of gaffer's tape to represent the cracks, building the frames, the mitering the joints, which not miter, doing miter joints or butt joints or however he framed them, and building the frames the way he did. For me, building stuff is a meditation.
Okay.
That's where I'm like, Mike, Jordan, like that's my area of mastery. And I mean, I was having a meeting with my studio manager yesterday, Aram, and we're talking about this annoying thing. And I was like, we were like fighting, and I just like picked up some plywood and I was just started to like cut the plywood, and I just felt better and I was less combative.
Wow. Like it was literally therapeutic for you.
Yeah. And I realized that I hadn't like used the jigsaw and like, 3 months.
That's not right. See, it's no not. Wonder, it's, no it's, wonder you're raging, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I'm living in sin.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm a sinner, and I have to repent through the Church of Plywood and pray to the Lord, the gods of plywood. Gods.
I'll tell you what, though, I don't know if it's the same there where you are, but ply's gone up 4 times the price during the pandemic over here in the UK.
Really?
We just made a half pipe, like a mini ramp in my studio. And my gosh, like if we'd have made that mini ramp in the studio before the pandemic, it would have been like a quarter of the price.
Do we know why?
I haven't got to the bottom of it yet.
Just shipping, everything's fucked up and
something's happening.
People don't, like, we can't get materials, everything's slowed down.
It could be.
But plywood should be 4 times as expensive.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, we should take care of it and make, I mean, it's always been, you know, Frank Gehry is one of my all-time heroes, made when he made this, all of his furniture and wall coverings in like AC plywood, which is kind of like not low-end plywood, but it's certainly not fancy plywood. It's like construction grade plywood, but he's the one who kind of elevated it to a finished material.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you spent time in Gehry's furniture thing.
I did. I worked for him for a little while, but like he was the guy who helped me to see that you could take something that was kind of low and elevate it and make something low even into a status symbol, a symbol of power. So like we build everything in that stuff, and now we're really picky, and there is shittier plywood that we don't use. We use this like very specific grade, like AC, like A is like superlative, C means average, just like in school.
Oh, wow. It's that specific.
So A one side and C on the other side, the good side. But you can get AA or you can get CD.
That's the high quality stuff.
No, there's much higher, but we like A and C, and it's like a very specific.
Because we've been using like the birch faced ply, and it's like £100 a sheet.
I believe it.
Yeah.
That's a lot. 100 pounds?
Yeah.
For 3/4 inch?
Yeah.
Or 10 mil is it probably?
Yeah, it's 10 mil. Huh.
Mm. 4 feet by 8 feet or 5 by 1, 2 meters?
Yeah, eight by four. It's extreme. It's real over here.
How thick is that veneer? Is it thin? Is that paper thin or is it like 1/8 inch thick veneer?
No, it's thin.
Yeah.
It's pretty thin.
Yeah.
But, oh no, you're joking. Not now, not again. It's flipping Gail Porter. Hold that thought a sec, Tom. Hello?
Stuart. Stuart,
yes.
Stuart, are you there?
Yes, Gail, I'm always here.
Right, someone next door has asked if they want to be my friend. So I've kind of run out of friends. Do you think I should go and make friends?
Definitely. And get their phone number.
Do you think, how far am I allowed to go?
You're allowed to go next door, don't worry. It's fine. That's allowed.
All right, okay. All okay, right. Great.
Good.
Okay, all I'll right. call you back in about 5 minutes. Shall
no,
I call you in 5 minutes?
I'm doing the podcast. Bye.
Oh.
Dude, I'm so sorry. But going back to the Gary thing, I did read that whilst you were there, you discovered Noeling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mate, look, in my studio, yeah, it's not like you run a tight ship there. I'm in awe. You know, your systems are tight. People behave. They follow the code. It's good. My studio is not like yours. It is flipping chaos. You know, nothing is nulled. Everything's in the wrong place. There's no structure whatsoever. So I'm wondering if you can just give me an insight into that sort of studio practice, how you came to Noeling, what the rules are, why you implemented it, and what's going on there, because I think that's fascinating.
So Noeling means to organize like objects in parallel or 90-degree angles as a way of creating a little bit more space in your life. In other words, you're not really cleaning up and putting everything away, but you're gridding it out on a table so that you can see what's ahead, what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an illusion. It's not really cleaning up, but it kind of looks like it's cleaning up. And it's also a form of meditation. Oh. So when you don't know what to do, null all of your stuff. If you're looking for something that's missing, null all your stuff. You're touching everything. You're seeing what's around you. You're connecting. You're taking a cigarette break without smoking. You're connecting yourself. You're disconnecting from the immediate task while still staying connected adjacently. You're taking a break, but you're still in the room. Mm-hmm. And you're buying a little perspective. Mm-hmm. The only reason we're so organized is because of real estate. We do not have enough space for what we're trying to do. So I think if we had a bigger studio, we would be messier.
Okay.
I know this to be true. We've got a warehouse that's a giant warehouse that's like 3 hours from here,
yeah.
Which is just hell. No one wants to go there. It's a Rust Belt town. It was just like what we could afford. Mm. And it is shambles.
You don't know where
it took us 6 months to build a shelf there.
Yeah, I could believe it. Yeah.
It's organized. Aram's saying it's organized.
Oh, well, there might have to be a spot check to find out.
Okay.
It's not perfection.
Aram's saying it's organized compared to the average artist. I don't give a fuck about the average artist.
Yeah, that's the point.
That's like I only succeed because of my own standards of excellence. And please, if there are any artists out there listening, the only standards of excellence that matter are your own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's one other thing. I think there's a key piece of inspiration I got from you, and it's the idea that not all messages that you send out that are received are also understood. And I've started to learn this in my studio, that I'll go in there and say blah blah blah, we got to do this, da 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 da, and everybody nods as if they've sort of like received the message, but I don't think they've understood. And I noticed this a few weeks later when nothing's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how you navigate that, because it seems that like there is a sense that the studio really does understand what you're trying to communicate and what you're trying to make and what the work is and what it, and also conceptually what it means, right? Because I think there's two parts to this. Like, it seems to me that there's a conceptual understanding by those that support you in the studio as to what you're trying to do. And I find there's a real gap. Is that important to you? Do they have to get the meaning of it, or do they simply have to be able to execute?
Well, first of all, I guess I'm going to take it as some kind of compliment that you and others think that we're organized. To me, it's shambles.
Okay.
All right. So, and maybe, you know, what is that? There's that thing that the Buddhist father believes he is inadequate. He's always trying harder. The father who thinks he's doing a good job probably isn't, or something like that. That's some mindfulness teaching I read somewhere. Anyway, whatever. But it's the same here. It's like, it's a process. And yeah, sent does not mean received. What you send doesn't mean just because he said it doesn't mean it was heard. Mm-hmm. Also, what was said isn't always the same thing as what was being heard. So, you know, and this is because there's a signal that's generated and travels from a brain to a mouth, goes through the air to an ear to another brain.
Mm-hmm.
And in between that, there is a whole bunch of what's scientifically called noise. In other words, something, there could be some background noise that would obscure the words being said. But in addition to that, there is another form of noise called language that gets in the way. You know, are you speaking the same language? Are you being clear in what you're saying? That's a huge question. And most importantly, did you get confirmation? Like you say, you know, someone nodding their head is a form of confirmation. It's pretty vague, but it at least knows that you at least know that they received a message. There's no indication that they've received that message unless you have a history of that nodding resulting in concrete results. If you have a history that someone's nodding and they're still fucking it up, then all that nod means is that they know that you sent a message. There's no indication that that message was transcribed or internalized, or maybe it was, but then there's another bit of, it's not quite noise anymore, but there's another, I'm just going to call it a problem for lack of a better word, between receiving the message and executing on it. And there's like a whole host of other sort of things that could get in the way. You know, feedback and fear is probably the biggest. I'm not going to exactly call it noise because I don't think technically that's right, but like hindrance between something being executed, being sent, received, and then executed.
I think fear is really interesting. And I think that's a huge part of what is going on. And this is exactly why I built the mini ramp, right? Because you have to drop in. You have to lean forward and fall into the ramp. And you need people to be brave enough to take the risk to actually execute. And I think this is key to this.
But mini ramps are so treacherous. You need like the barrier for entry is so high.
Exactly, but there's only one way to go, and that is to lean in fully.
Do you have a full pad set or no?
Yeah, we've got like stuff. But we make them sign a waiver, you know, so like if anything happens, it's totally their fault.
But wait, skaters don't need waivers. Skaters don't sue. There's a code.
Yeah, but they work in my studio. They're like studio assistants. They're on the payroll. Like there's like laws. If they break a leg at work...
But what kind of, I mean, are these people who know how to ride skateboards?
No, or never most done of them have never done it before in their life.
Oh, yeah, this is good that you're signing a waiver then.
But yeah, no, I think fear is a big thing.
We have a thing in the studio that like if there's a light bulb that needs to be changed really high up on a ladder or something dangerous, we send someone who's ridden a skateboard before because there is a unwritten rule that you don't sue for something that you, if you injure yourself physically ever.
That's good.
A little studio hack. And also because a skater, if you can ride a skateboard, you are not going to fall off a ladder. It's just like ladders are so much easier. And like people, you know, ladder injuries are like the most devastating workplace injuries, right? Like but skaters do not fall off ladders. And if they do fall off a ladder, they land on their feet. Like I'm not worried about them.
Or laugh about it.
Yeah. Or like it's like a sign of bravado. And if they sue, they're like cowards and banished.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Tom, that sounds like the perfect place to head over to Sarah Maple's studio to see what make she's got set up for us all this week. Sarah, are you there?
I'm here.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. I've got a Nigella style one for you today.
Ooh, this sounds good. Right, what do they need to do?
Find 3 different fruits or vegetables in your house. Cut them into pieces as you wish. Now place them on top of each other to create a new sculptural form. Put it in front of an interesting backdrop and take a photo. Voila! Sculpture.
Oh, sculpture. This week's Maples Makes is a sculpture challenge, a la Nigella herself. So let's see all your food-tastic creations using the hashtag Maples Makes, and Sarah and I will check them out. And I think you'd enjoy doing that, Tom. Right. Anyway, where were we? So I'm taking it from some of the things you said that you meditate, you like to meditate, you're interested in that kind of philosophy. Is that fair?
No, I hate meditation.
Interesting.
How do you know if someone meditates? Don't worry, they'll tell you. You know, it's like, I believe I find my meditation through making stuff like ceramics, running, plywood, weightlifting. Because when I'm doing those things, I can only be doing those things. I can't do anything else.
Yeah.
I'll get into an extreme situation where things are really stressful. I'll need to like go in a quiet place and think about, close my eyes and think about them for a little time. That's as close as I'll get to meditation.
But the other week, you went on quite a long walk to the beach as well, I noticed. Yeah. So how was that? I mean, where did you decide to walk it? I'm just sort of fascinated by that.
So we're teaching a semester on conceptual art, and I'm really interested in particular, a genre called endurance art. So endurance art, maybe famous people of endurance art are people like Yoko Ono or Adrian Piper or Chris Burden. But without a doubt, to me, the ultimate is Taiching She, who spent a year tied by a rope to another person.
Wow. I had no idea. And they can't touch each other.
That was just the rules that they set up. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I'm interested in conceptual art is that you set up a rule. Spend 1 year tied by an 8-foot rope to another person, and they're not allowed to touch. Those are the boundaries of the piece. And then it just takes a moment to describe, but a year to execute. And I'm sure there are countless amazing stories of how weird that year was for them.
Yeah, and, can you imagine?
And that's where the art exists, is within the boundaries of those rules. So when I walked to Rockaway, I did, my rules were walk someplace you'd normally drive. So I walked to the beach, which is 17.5 miles from here, and I'd normally drive there, but I decided to walk. And sort of my experience of walking there is, there are a lot of interesting things happened. And it was definitely a form of meditation. Although I don't want to say I made the mistake of Instagramming, storing it the whole way, but that definitely took away from it being kind of a Zen experience. Although I wound up making a little movie with Charlie about the experience. I posted some stories. I felt like I engaged a lot of people. So that was kind of the trade-off, was output. I was able to output and share the experience. That was what I think I got out of it. And I think I was able to help other people find their version of that. And there were some incredible submissions to the wear testing program that other people did.
I mean, I think that's such a beautiful thing, the way that a lot of your work is so participatory and so global and so inclusive. And I think that's really nice. Like my son's nearly 12. And I think at one point you were making a geodesic dome or something, because he's following you on Instagram. And I'm coming home and like my son's making like this full, he's got the full Buckminster Fuller going on.
Yes.
Like, where have you got that from, Ari? Like, what's happening here?
Great.
Thanks to you. So I think this is a beautiful thing.
Oh, I'm so honored. That's huge. That's huge. I love that. That's the whole point. I mean, I think it's something we share, Stuart. You have an inclusiveness. I think that's why we have a relationship, because I'm not going to name names, but there are some artists that are not about inclusiveness. And I think we both find that revolting.
Yeah, for sure.
I know that that's driven you to action, which I really admire, and that you continue with your quest and dedication for inclusiveness. It's very important here. Everyone in the studio here had like a hard time in high school. I think that's why we're all friends. And we work really hard to make sure that the things that make us special can really shine here. And I pride the studio in being a place where the nerds reign.
Oh, mate, do you know what? That just, my heart loves that. It's the same in my studio. We're the weirdest mix of dropout weirdos that you'd ever meet. But we're cool. There's something special. You know, we may have all been bullied at school, but somehow we found each other and we're making things and it makes sense. And I don't know. I totally get what you mean. It's beautiful that you've got a place for that, like a sanctuary for the weirdos. It's like in the movie The Craft, at the end, she's like, "We are the weirdos, mister." I love that quote.
Yeah, yeah, we are the yes.
We are the weirdos. And yeah, I totally get that. I mean, I don't know if you saw the other day, but we made Eve Klein Blue available. I made an incredibly Kleinish blue because, of course, IKB is trademarked, International Klein Blue. So we made an incredibly Kleinish blue. And I'm very inspired by Klein. So in the package, when you buy IKB, it looks like Calvin Klein CK1 perfume. It's like a kind of bootleg. But inside, it has a bottle of absolutely nothing. We give away absolutely nothing with every order. And I love Klein's play with the nothing, the conceptual nature of nothing.
Wait, so is it aquamarine blue, or is it an empty bottle, or was it filled with air?
No, there's an ultramarine blue, but the interesting thing about Klein's formula when he worked in Paris was it's not just the color, it's the whole paint formula that made it very powdery, very pigmented, very matte. So we've completely mimicked that, but also it's scented like Calvin Klein CK1.
Oh, I see, it's scented, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And then it also comes with another bottle that has nothing in it at all, and it says absolutely nothing. So it comes with absolutely nothing. Like, we've included absolutely nothing with every bottle. So I just like that conceptual play. Yeah. And like, I know that you kind of like, there's a humor in what you do.
There's that piece that Marcel Duchamp did, the 10 cc's of Air of Paris. You know about that one?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So it's kind of, that's, I mean,
it's all in that same orbit. And interestingly, like, we've got a show on at the moment. We've got a little gallery under my studio. We're showing Ron Arad's crushed bottle rack, which he calls one of his hedgehogs. And I don't know. It's a whole geeky world that I'm kind of obsessed with.
That's awesome. I was just at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and I saw that little ampule of air last week.
Did you?
And it's one of my favorites, and this is Marcel Duchamp went to a pharmacy and had the pharmacist seal up a bottle of Air of Paris and brought it to Philadelphia to give to the Aronsons as a present. And I was just really taken by that, which probably meant more than it does now, just because I think it was probably a little harder to get from Paris to Philadelphia than it is now. And then at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., there's a similar piece that was done by the Apollo 11 crew where they had a little vial of nothing that they opened up on the moon and then closed on the moon. So it's got moon air, or it did. I don't know what happens 50 years later. No, there's no seal on Earth that is 100% entropy proof.
That's beautiful. It reminds me, actually, do you know who Tobias Wong is? Wong. Yeah. Yeah, from New York. And he did a piece. Oh, obviously he passed away. It was very sad, actually. But before he passed away, he made a piece where he filled like almost like candy floss bags with air. And he stood on the corner, I think it was Prince Street, and he had like a candy floss thing. And he had these bags of air and he was selling them for $1 each. And it was like, if you can't sell a dream for $1, you have no business being an art dealer. And it was the idea of an artist coming out on the street to sell their work. And it was nothing. It was just an idea. It was the non-tactility of nothing, you know, just the concept was enough. And I thought that was one of the most beautiful things that Toby ever made. And it just reminds me of that.
Yeah. I think conceptual art, it's an important time to be reevaluating what conceptual art means, especially with all this NFT craze and our ever-increasing reliance on alternative realities. I don't want to say, you know, I think we have it's like we don't like to say in the real world when we're talking about digital art, because it's just as real as but we do like to say the plywood world versus the metaverse. Yeah.
I mean, I think this is something that's annoying me about the whole NFT, you know, like digital art's real art. Like These people really make art. They care about it. It's their work. Yeah. It just happens to exist digitally. It's not fake art. It's not not art. It's not nothing.
Well, but I think this is the moment for art, for the world to start to really understand that. I think that's the good thing about the NFT craze, is that it's starting to help people come to terms with other realities than the ones that they're familiar with.
For sure. And also, like, you saw the Monjun. You spent a lot of time with it, more than Cy Newhouse, who owned it. You don't have to own the art to have the art. The art's an experience, right? And, you know, I think people are starting to understand that. Like, I find it crazy when people are that obsessed with it, because it's like, the art's free. The art will outlive you. You know, the art's there. You know, you just got to bother to turn up to the museum every day and sit in front of it. You have every access to the thing, which is why I think NFTs are interesting, because all you're really buying is the right to be the buyer. You that's what you get. You get the right to be the person that bought it. You get the right to be, you buy the right to be the owner, but you don't actually get the thing.
Well, unless the NFT is linked to something in the physical world. Like, for example, you buy a ticket to a movie, right? And then you show up at the theater and you take out your phone and you show them the barcode and they scan it. Mm-hmm. And that's an NFT. And then that NFT disappears and they let you into the theater. You bought that ticket. And between the buying of the ticket and the moment it was scanned, you were the owner of it, and you could scalp it on the street if you wanted to. And it bought you a tangible thing in the plywood world. We don't say real world. We say plywood world. Until we figure out a better word to use.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe you could do an NFT where the certificate of authenticity, the NFT, the document, buys you the right to something. Now, Marcel Duchamp displaying a toilet, a urinal, mm-hmm. which is no different from another urinal you could buy in the store, except for this one he signed. And he said, this one is mine and I place no value on it. The value is what you decide, the market and the community. And I think that we're just at the beginning of this. So I think there's a lot of gray stuff going on, but I see a potential where it's just another form of money, which is just an illusion by which we all live and die.
I mean, it's sort of like, you know, going back to the conceptual art, and I think it is important because, you know, like Yves Klein, for example, you know, he famously sold nothing, and he, you know, you bought nothing. You bought a bit of space that had nothing in it from him, and he gave you a check. And, you know, in order to complete the piece of work, you had to set fire to the check. So you paid him in gold. So you gave Klein gold for nothing. He gave you a check. You had to set fire to the check as the collector. And then he would put half the gold in the Seine. And this is fantastic. The piece isn't complete until it becomes completely nothing. It's incomplete if there's still a check. So you have to burn the only token you have. And I think this is way ahead of the NFT when you think about it.
I think it's that piece. I don't know what that piece is called, but
I don't know either.
I've heard that story before, and I think that is the fundamental. I think that is the best case example of linking the conceptual art world, because Klein and Duchamp were the, you know, forefathers of this kind of thinking to our time. But again, I think it's the connection to the physical world that made that piece so resonant, that there was a check, which is another abstract thing because it's just words on worthless paper, but that there was real exchange happening with gold, which also is questionable value because it's a commodity and it's bought and sold and traded and goes up and down, and it's only valuable because we all believe it to be. I mean, sure, it's scarce, but so is a lot of other stuff.
It's commodities, isn't it? It's like, it's Manzoni's shit. I mean, he swapped that for gold as well. I mean, and we, you know, what is the standard now when it's crypto and it's like ether? And I don't know. I'm confused. I've got to admit, Tom, I'm a bit confused by the whole thing.
It's a lot to take in suddenly if it's new. I think it's something that a lot of people have been working on for a long time, and a lot of attention's being brought to it. But these are people that are dedicated years towards working on this. So I think it's just, I think as every day goes by and you see more and more examples of it in your life, it will become more familiar. It's definitely hard to wrap your head around, but I think that you know and understand and are willing to accept that Yves Klein piece puts you way ahead of the competition, Stuart.
Okay.
Well, that's the hard thing to wrap your head around. Aram just interrupted me to remind me to say it's about accessing transparency, which we're, you and I are both committed to. And the blockchain is like a spreadsheet where you can see it all. There's no secrets.
I know. And this is what's beautiful about it. You can see who owned it, where it was, how much it was last sold for. You can track the whole thing. And it also feels very accessible and very transparent and open. And it feels like almost anyone could add something to this blockchain, or anyone could buy it. You know, I don't need to know the right person. I don't need to represent a big museum. I'm not buying on behalf of someone, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think this is fascinating. You know, it feels very democratic in a lot of ways.
I mean, I think there are still clicks, right? Like if you want to get in on a certain NFT, you have to be in a community and know that it's going to be launched and stuff. But besides that, in principle, it is, and more than anything, the idea of it being decentralized, that the blockchain isn't owned by a bank, that information about the value of those, of the currency, of the Ether or the Bitcoin or whatever, is spread out over so many servers that are, like, literally, there isn't a centralized bank. It's decentralized. It's all over the place.
Well, this seems like the perfect place for a message from our sponsor.
40 years ago, I was down a fucking mine shaft swinging a pick and shoveling shite. These days, it's all about mining crypto. Tommy Kyle, get involved before it goes interstellar. Interstellar.
And a huge thank you to all the guys at Tommy Coin who make the Stuart Semple show possible. Right. I had an argument with somebody who was trying to tell me that crypto was bad. And I was like, and they were from a developing country, you know. And I was like, I sort of get what you're saying, but the first thing that the colonialists did when they arrived was made you sign up to a flipping federal banking system. You're in debt to trillions of dollars to people in the West. How on earth is crypto not a liberating freedom thing?
Wasn't that one of the original ideas? The guy who invented I think it was Bitcoin, was that it was for developing places, because if you're in the savannah, you don't have access to a bank, but you have access to a cell phone and you could do banking from, you could use crypto to buy agricultural products in a way that money doesn't work.
Absolutely. You become your own bank. And I think, I don't know. I think there's a lot of good in it. I'm one of the few people who's kind of thinking that this is going to evolve in a beautiful way. I'm ever optimistic about things like this. I think it could be really good.
I'm excited for what it can do in all kinds of things, but for art, which is the area that you and I occupy, where we work, is a huge opportunity. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the art world, or I don't want to say the art world because that's loaded, you know, with like the different, there are different art worlds and different groups, but that artists are kind of leading the public charge on this new way of doing commerce is really interesting. That's never happened before.
Oh, good point. Yeah, that's exciting. That's very punk, actually.
It is, because they're individuals and they're misfits and fuck ups and they play by their own rules. And so people are inventing their own ways of doing this. And what's really cool about it is this thing that that you can write all the rules, that you create the attributes for the work of art. You describe what it is. You say, this is represents your right to own the thing. It doesn't give you the right to reproduce the NFT, right? Or it does. Or you can use it. It represents the right for you to do something in the real world or not. And there are some people that say these attributes are subject to change. And when you buy the NFT, that's you.
Oh, really? Wow. So it's like an unfinished work. So you can come back and revisit that.
There are really no rules, just like in art. There are really no, but there is this thing that's very important called trust. Mm-hmm. So if you say there's an edition of one or edition of 100 and you change that and it makes it worse for the buyer, they're not going to trust you when you do the next one. Just like in just like in plywood art.
Yeah, you know, just like if we were signing prints and we made a load more, we'd be in trouble.
Well, you'd be in trouble, but more than anything, your credibility would be lost. So you wouldn't be able to repeat it. And I think that that is a way to ensure that serious people in this world will be honest and forthcoming. And if they'd make changes, that they're the kind of changes that aren't going to piss anyone off.
But it is also, in a lot of ways, sort of bootleg proof, isn't it? Because You know, it's so trans, you know, it, and you and me both share a joy of the bootleg. Like you with your Chanel glasses. I used to collect bootleg DVDs. Guys used to come around bars and clubs in London with like bootleg DVDs, and they were so bad. You know, you'd see someone like walk across the movie theater, you know, in the middle of it. And I used to just think they were cool because they looked so bad, like the printouts of these like weird imported covers. So we kind of won't see that anymore. You know, it protects artists' rights in one way because they can't have their work ripped off. But in another way, like the deviations, maybe we won't see as many, which might be a loss in a way.
Yeah. Well, I'd be surprised. People are pretty creative. I mean, I think to me, what's interesting is the trade war with the West and China, because like China doesn't really respect intellectual property.
Tom, do you know what happened? They registered my name and my signature as a trademark in China. And we fought it for a year and we lost. So they can now make paint with my name and signature on it in China and sell it. And if I try and sell my paint in China, they can sue me.
Why? How's that work? Why? In what court did you fight? And
the intellectual property office in China, you can fight with, but they ain't listening. It's real. They literally, it's my signature and my name in like every category going in China. It's really spooky.
That sounds really like unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. So, yeah.
Maybe that's something that we need to worry about. Obviously, if it's happening to you, but I just don't understand. So
I would register it straight away if you haven't, but that's a separate thing.
All right. Well, I guess, okay. So I guess my point that I was trying to, I mean, I'm shocked to hear that, but also not really, because we all have experienced bootleg stuff and then it happened to you. I'm sorry. That's a bummer. But it's always been, you know, the idea of patent is pretty new, right? It's just like 300 or 400 years old, European origin, kind of comes along with the Industrial Revolution, roughly. Mm-hmm. And before that, it was really he who was quickest to market or provided the best value. Or delivered within the marketplace was the one that would win. And if you think of the history of China, it's much, much older than that. The Chinese have been making things much, much longer. So it's never – so this is kind of a new measure of ownership that's been thrust upon China. And I think that's why we're having kind of like an ideological conflict of the West and China. Like, you know, the Huawei phones stealing Apple – technology. And that's why the Trump administration captured Cathy Meng, the CFO and the daughter of the principal of Huawei, and is keeping her as a kind of like war prisoner, right? Like they physically captured her in Canada, and I think she's still incarcerated. They're not letting her out because they kind of got like the damsel in distress. I don't know if she's out yet, but wow. Certainly a bargaining chip in this, because there's a human being involved. Obviously a very powerful one. I wonder where she's at. I've been meaning to keep tabs on where Kathy's being held.
That's shocking. I had no idea.
I mean, I think it makes sense. I mean, it's in war you do stuff like that. Capture the bad guy's daughter. Hold her ransom. Well, see if he's willing to talk. But is he the bad guy, or does he just have a different set of values?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it's a totally different culture and with a different perspective on things. But I think, I don't know. But I do think that there's something that you said once, I can't remember where it was, but the idea of things lasting, like for instance, you know, you turn up at a thrift store and there's a piece of art and somebody saved it because it was a piece of art. You know, they didn't want to just throw this thing away. And I've seen that, like really bad art in like, we call them charity shops here. But someone looked after the thing, you know, because it was art. And I think the good things do tend to last. Like when they're robust, you know, the robust making of something that's made to last, that has a durability, that isn't trying to be here for a minute and duck out. I think that there's a quality in that that sort of transcends ownership.
Yeah, I remember when I was in school, my best friend, I was always saying, I don't really like believe in the museum system. I just want work to exist in the world. And he said, well, how would you feel if like something you worked really hard on wound up at a thrift shop? And I thought to myself, besides the whole money thing, like, yeah, I want my stuff in the most expensive environment so I can afford to like pay my team more and stuff. Besides that detail, an important detail, I think that's fine. I mean, I think of the magic that you found in a charity shop, right? You found some of your prized possessions there. I certainly have. And, you know, it's just the, you know, the money system that makes that a stigma. Spirit, like I watched a really obnoxious YouTube about some guy was talking about he makes like reproductions of art, like very high quality ones, and he was name dropping Walter Benjamin's work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction. He said in that he talks about the original work of art has an aura, and that the reproduced one doesn't. And he says, I reject that, and I reject him name dropping Walter Benjamin and then just to buy credibility and then just to reject it, like as if the audience isn't listening. How dumb do you think your listeners are? I think the original work of art has authenticity. And I think that can include the digital realm too. It's just a different measure of what that is. And I don't think there's anything wrong with reproducing art. You know, I think it's really cool that you can buy an Andy Warhol painting for $50 million, and then you can buy a print of one for $10,000, and you can buy a poster of the same image for like $100. And it's all, or maybe even a poster of in a museum shop for $10. And that there's access points for everyone along the way.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I totally agree with you. At every level, you know, that's what art should be.
And they're all authentic. You know, they're all different.
Yeah, that it's just that form. It's still a real one. It's a real postcard, right? You know, the argument would be, of course, that it cheats you from the experience of the real thing. So the argument is, we've all seen the Mona Lisa so many times that when we come in contact with the real Mona Lisa, we don't see it. We see our memory in the recollection. But I don't buy it either. I'm totally on your side with that.
But also, like, the Mona Lisa is behind so many layers of, like, bullet-rated polycarbonate laminated Lexgard that you can't even see it, and it's not lit well, so it's kind of not really, it may not be there.
Oh, who cares? It's boring.
What? One of them's in a port.
Oh, those are two Mona Lisas, and one's
there.
Oh yeah, one's totally stashed in some vault somewhere, you know it.
But he painted two, or one's a display copy, or what?
Hasn't been fully explored.
Oh, no one really knows.
But actually, when it moved, I don't know if you saw, but there was a whole procession through the streets. It was like this huge moment, like the moving of the thing, and this whole like carnivalesque like procession when it moved. Weird. People were that bothered by paintings in those days.
Yeah, I think that stuff is part of the theatricality and pageantry, like that charade, the ceremony of that parade, the Swiss vault, which they had in that movie, Tenet, which was too hard for me to understand. I'm not smart enough to understand. It's pretty hard to follow, but it's got the best fight scene that I've seen in years. In a kitchen, he uses a cheese grater. That's his weapon to defend himself against like five dudes.
I might have to watch it.
It's not, I can't recommend it, but it's fun.
Is it about the Mona Lisa?
No, it's just like...
some art heist thing.
Yeah, it's an art heist moment. It's not important.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Well, Tom, we've spoken about lots of interesting things.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed it.
This is great. Well, we have to keep the conversation going, man. We get little props. We're doing a show in Hamburg called Space Program 4 in September at Deisterhallen.
Good.
Black 3.0. plays a pivotal role as our representation of our abyss.
I'm excited to see this.
We're mixing your paint with ground up cell phones to create our existential abyss, because, you know, there are only 10 to the 80th power number of atoms in the universe. So that means with every breath you take, you're inhaling part of Julius Caesar's body.
What? Wait, hang on.
Yeah.
Currently inhaling part of Julius Caesar's body.
Right now, and so am I. There are that few atoms. in the universe that thing everything is recycled mixed.
Hang on. So we're obviously also inhaling coronavirus.
Yes. Well, not necessarily, because just, you know, the atoms that we are inhaling atoms that could be part of a virus, yes, but they don't necessarily synthesize a virus in the way that you don't necessarily synthesize Julius Caesar's body.
I'm not inhaling his nose.
But the atoms, yeah. You could be.
Okay, so
it could have been an atom that was in his nose. It could have been an atom that was in your neighbor's coronavirus.
So in September, we're going to see the ground up phones that are in the paint.
Yeah. No, I think you should come and see the show. I think I just wanted to name drop it, but also say that in June, we've got a show in London.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, and I don't know if we're going to be allowed to come. If we can without quarantine, I'll be there. If not, I won't. And that is at Tadeusz Ropak.
Well, I will go, for sure.
Thank you. And that's at Tadeusz Ropak Gallery.
Oh, great, yeah. And what are you showing?
Yeah, I can. It's called Ritual. And we had a little show at the height of the pandemic in Paris. So it's kind of like an extension of that show.
Did it get canceled?
No, we had it. And it was the all-time gallery record, but it was only people in Paris saw it.
Congratulations, that's brilliant.
But it was so successful, we're going to do it again in London during that art weekend where everything stays open late.
Yeah
June 3rd.
Okay, cool. Well, I will go. I'd love to see it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tom, thanks for coming on. I know that you're a busy guy with a lot going on, family and work and all sorts of stuff, so it means a lot.
Well, I appreciate all your support and believing in what we do and being another fighter for equality and accessibility to everyone and believing.
Mm, well, we will. We'll keep going and you'll keep going and it will be good.
Awesome.
The geeks are taking over.
Yes.
Okay, loads of love. Bye, Tom. Thank you. Well, that's it, everyone. The end of another episode. Thanks so much for joining me. Now, next week, my dear friend, Lowry Love, is coming in to the studio. So it's a chance for you to get up close and personal with me and one of the most awesome and inspiring computer hackers ever. Until then, if you do want to stay in touch, see what I'm up to, say hi or whatever, you can find me on social over at Instagram at Stuart Semple or Twitter at Stuart Semple. Otherwise, just search Stuart Semple on Google and I'll come up. Okay, love you all. Be excellent to one another. See you next time.